across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells and Kerry Deese of Preferred Financial. Join us for the next hour. We're going to take a look at the ins and outs of mortgage financing. Today, Kerry, we're going to try to cover about four different topics. We're going to talk about qualifying income, and we're going to talk about how a lender uses that qualifying income to determine affordability of a house. We're going to talk about down payment, where it can come from, how you get it, how much you have to have. And finally, we're going to talk about the impact of credit scores and other factors on your interest rate calculations. So first, we're going to tackle the subject of qualifying income. And Kerry, what do we mean by qualifying income?
How much we can use and what income you need in order to qualify for your loan.
Okay. And, of course, your income is earned weekly, biweekly, monthly, annually, and all that. But a lender uses a monthly income as your qualifying income. And then they calculate all of your debt payments, your future house payment if you're going to buy a house, as well as your other debt obligation payments in calculating the affordability of the home that you're looking at buying. But they use a monthly income. However, the monthly income that is used has quite a few guidelines.
Just a few hundred.
So the basic guidelines divide borrowers into two categories. You are either a statutory employee, and Kerry, how can someone know if they're a statutory employee? What will they get to verify that?
If you receive a W-2, not a 1099, but a W-2.
That's correct. And then the very opposite, you might actually work for a company as such, but you are working as an independent contractor, and you would receive a 1099. That is a completely different type of borrower than a statutory employee. So a statutory employee uses and receives W-2s for income. A 1099 recipient is just like a self-employed borrower and will be treated as such. And we'll talk about how we derive income, qualifying income for a self-employed borrower. But first, let's cover statutory employees. It ought to be pretty straightforward. They got W-2s. You divide by 12, and that's their monthly income. Right, Kerry?
Well, not quite.
Not really.
If it were that easy,
that's right. They wouldn't pay us the big bucks if it was that easy. So when you are a statutory employee, what can be counted as 1/12 of your income or your monthly qualifying income is what we would term your base pay. Now, base pay, if you are a salaried borrower, is the annual salary that you're paid. However, base pay for an hourly employee is based on how many hours, Kerry?
40 hours a week.
Okay, so 40 hours a week is considered full-time. And if you're paid hourly, then we have to verify that your employer provides you with a 40-hour-a-week job in order to count all those hours. Now, we have some types of businesses, though, who consider their employees full-time, and yet they don't work 40 hours. What are some of those industries?
You know, sometimes we see that in healthcare. Mm-hmm. If you work three 12-hour
yep.
shifts for your 36
That's
hours.
That's a common one. Retail. Mm-hmm. Retail even considers 32 hours as kind of a normal work week with many of their workers. So mm-hmm. We do have to determine, once we have your hourly rate of pay, whether on average your employer is saying, okay, our work week is a 40-hour work week, or it's a 36 or a 32-hour work week. The key is we can count the income for the job that you are on at the rate you are being paid as long as your position is considered full-time.
Right.
If your position is considered part-time, then all of a sudden we've got a whole other set of rules that come to play in qualifying income. So we always begin with a statutory employee by saying, what is your salary or what is your hourly rate of pay? And if you're paid hourly, what are the number of hours that your employer considers you to work full time? And we mark that down as your monthly income. Now, we can add to that monthly income if you are paid in some other ways and forms. Kerry, let's talk about other additional income that someone might earn above and beyond their normal monthly base pay.
Overtime would be the biggest one.
And that's the most common one we find. And the question always comes up, can we count overtime? And indeed we can. In fact, we're going to talk about a rule that is universal for all other types of income other than your full-time base pay. And that's what we call irregular income. And it's just because overtime, shift differentials, things like that can change from year to year, from month to month, from week to week. And so that income is not guaranteed and it's not regular. So we call it irregular income. What are some other irregular income sources, Carrie, other than overtime and, say, shift differentials?
Commission is a huge one.
If you're in sales.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bonuses.
Bonuses, because, you know, although we'd like to think our bonuses are guaranteed because we're so good.
Right.
the company doesn't always get to pay them because business is not always as good. So bonus income can be irregular. Now, there's a rule that you should remember when you're calculating your own qualifying income that applies to all irregular income. And what do we call that one, Carrie?
Well, if you've been a fan of our show for a while, I'm sure you've noticed this theme. It is the two-year rule.
The two-year rule. And what does that mean in practical ways for our borrower? If you have bonus or overtime or commission or shift differential, how does the two-year rule apply?
As long as you have received that other income, overtime bonus, shift differential, commission, for 2 years, and it is likely to continue, then we can count those other sources of income in your qualifying numbers.
That's right. And how do we go about determining how much that irregular income actually is that we can credit them with?
We actually send a form to your employer to have them fill out that breaks all of that down for the past 2 years and the current year to date.
And then we have to average
right.
that number. So we occasionally have someone come in and says, I'm making $60,000 a year, but we find out that, well, they've got a base of $40,000, and for the last 2 weeks they've been working, you know, 90-hour weeks.
Right.
And unfortunately, we can't count what you just finished earning of irregular income. We have to go back, capture all of those irregular earnings over the last 2 years, and then we average those and add them to your base pay. Now, Carrie, when we do that, what about other potential places you might earn income? Like, what if someone has a second job?
Sure. Sure.
Can we count their second job income?
We can, as long as they've been on a part-time job for 2 years.
Okay, and I want to emphasize, too, because this sometimes gets lost in the shuffle, the irregular income that we average for 2 years means that you have to have been on the job you are currently on for 2 years to count it. And the same thing with a second job. We cannot, if you've had three different second jobs over the last 2 years, we don't get to average the second job income.
Right.
In order to count irregular income, you have to have been receiving it from the source you are currently employed with in order for us to count it. That applies for overtime, bonus, commission. One of the most difficult ones to handle, really, is our sales forces who may be highly commissioned, that when they change jobs, we're not actually able to count the commission income until they've been on that job for 2 full years. And so it can be very restrictive for someone changing a job. And this might feed into your home purchase planning or your home refinance planning. If you're thinking of changing jobs, what you may want to do is go ahead and do your move, buy your home before you change jobs, because you could be locked out of your new home purchase for 2 years waiting for all that commission income to accrue that we can average so that you qualify for the house that you want to qualify for. Now, we've covered statutory employees, and we need to now cover self-employed borrowers. And self-employed borrowers fall under the same two-year rule we've been talking about, but when we get back, we'll talk about how their income differs from a statutory employee.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining us this morning. We are currently talking about qualifying income. As always, if you have questions, give us a call at 864 435-9596. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And you can check out all of our past shows at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Thanks, Carrie. We had finished talking about statutory employees and the ability to count 100% of anyone's base salary who is a W-2 wage earner, and that we can also count their irregular income if they've been on their job for 2 years, and we average the irregular income over the 2 year period, add that to their base income for their qualifying income when they get ready to buy a house. We also talked about that you can hold a second job, a part-time job, and as long as you've been on that job for 2 years, again, the 2 year rule, we can also average the earnings from the part-time employment and add that to your basic earnings at your primary job. So we're going to move to self-employed borrowers, and although we're going to move into a completely different category of income calculation, we still have that 2 year rule.
Yep.
We can't get away from the 2 year rule. So self-employed borrowers, here's the issue. Until you have been self-employed for 2 years, evidenced by the filing of 2 years' tax returns, business tax returns, you actually cannot qualify for any mortgage product that we currently have, or that is currently out there, I should say. So the 2 year rule is a real stickler for self-employed borrowers. And then the nature of a startup means that sometimes the first year of operation is not a profitable year. That can kind of throw you when you go to get a mortgage loan, because the 2 year rule is also the rule of averaging. And if you started off your business, had no profit the year before, and this year you had $100,000 profit, well, we can't use that $100,000 to qualify you. We actually have to average the $100,000 with zero, and we come up with a $50,000 qualifying income. So self-employed borrowers represent, I think, one of the most difficult of the income categories. And here's another thing that all us self-employed borrowers do out there is we don't want to pay Uncle Sam any more than we have to. If we can find a write-off, we're going to write it off. And that is all well and good to save you money with Uncle Sam, but the problem is when you go to get a home, to buy a home, the lender is going to use not the gross income you reported from your business, but the net income after you took all those write-offs. That is a self-employed borrower's qualifying income. And I find this is the biggest misconception of most self-employed borrowers out there. In fact, if you just ask a self-employed borrower, what was your income last year, they will invariably tell you their gross receipts,
mm-hmm.
the total amount of money that they took in. But unfortunately, the lender looks at the net profit, which means you take all the gross receipts, you subtract out all of your business-related expenses, and the profit you reported is the income that the lender uses to qualify you with. That's your net income, not your gross income. Now, there are a couple of things that we get to throw back in to the income of a self-employed borrower, and that's some write-offs that you're allowed to take as a business that are really just paper write-offs and are not tangible. I wrote a check for this expenses. And so we're allowed to add these things back to a self-employed borrower's net profit. What are the items, Carrie, that we can add back in?
Depreciation is the biggest one, and that's both the standard depreciation
mm-hmm.
and Section 179 depreciation.
That's right, and rarely do we run into this in our neck of the woods. If you were in Texas, you would see a lot of depletion allowances. That's where you own an asset in which you are mining or depleting it as your business progresses, and you're allowed a depletion write-off. Those can be added back, too. We do occasionally run across borrowers who own parts of oil partnerships. And again, that's an item that can be added back in. But depreciation and Section 179 depreciation. And then, Carrie, by default, if you take an automobile expense write-off that's based on the mileage, then the IRS has built into your mileage write-off a certain percent of depreciation, and we can get that out of the automobile write-off and add it back to a borrower's income. So with those things, we're using net income, and we're averaging 2 years. So, Carrie, when a self-employed borrower comes to apply for a home loan, for a mortgage loan, what are they going to have to bring to us so we can verify what their qualifying income is?
Their most recent 2 years of personal tax returns.
And business.
And if they file separate business tax returns.
Correct. Yes.
We need 2 years of that as well.
And what else do we have to finish up the story?
A year-to-date profit and loss statement and balance statement.
That's correct. And so, Carrie, what would happen if, and this happens a lot, people who are self-employed, because they, I'm this way, you know, I'll wait as long as I can to file a tax return.
Sure.
I don't know, just putting off the inevitable or whatever, but I always file extensions and I always file my returns late. So what if we had a borrower at this time of the year who has put their 2017 tax return on extension and hasn't filed it yet? How do we document their income?
We'd have to do the 2016 and 2015 average.
That's right. So we technically we'd be going back 3 years to pick up the income, plus we'd have to have a profit and loss statement for 2017
and
a profit and loss statement for 2018 year to date. So if you're going to buy a house, file your tax returns early if you can. It will save you a little bit of headaches. Plus, it will probably pick up, you know, increasing income. Now, there are trends that underwriters look for in self-employed borrowers, and one of those is the trend of how has income compared in subsequent years. And the best scenario, what do we want to see?
We want to see increases each year.
Yeah, that's the big one. So the better each year gets, the more the underwriter says, hey, running a healthy business, things are looking good, and the profit and loss should support that trend also, you know,
right.
And that's a good thing. However, that's not always the case. We all ride ups and downs with our businesses. We go into funk sometimes, and the income's not as much, so we may have declining income to deal with. Now, there's one scenario in which declining income alone can be enough reason for an underwriter to turn down a self-employed borrower's loan, regardless of what their credit is, regardless of what their qualifying income is. And under what scenario, Carrie, might an underwriter say, you know, we just can't make this loan?
If it is declining year over year by at least 5%.
That's right, 5 to 10%. And it's a little bit subjective. But if there is declining income year over year that also flows into the current year's profit and loss statements, then you really have a difficult case to make. You have to have some awfully strong offsetting strengths for an underwriter to make a loan in the face of year over year declining income, because they have to project and say, well, what's going to reverse this, or what are we going to do 3 years from now when the income is half of what it was, and how are you going to make your house payment? So that can be an issue for self-employed borrowers. It's not an issue for statutory employees who have W-2 wages. If their income has declined because they changed jobs, well, they still get to count the income that they're currently earning. But a self-employed borrower is subject to a two-year average. And Carrie, what would happen if we had, say, a 2016 tax return that had $100,000 net profit, but 2017 we had about $50,000 profit, so there's declining income, but then the profit and loss shows, hey, things are getting better. How are they going to look at that borrower's income?
They're actually going to take only the 2017 income and divide it by 12.
Yeah, they're going to default to the worst case, aren't they? So the most recent tax year, if that is a declining year, that is pretty much going to become your qualifying income. They will not average the 2 years. They will take the lower of the most recent year. So, again, self-employed borrowers, you need to give us a call. Oftentimes, we get with your CPA, tax preparers, to get the tax documents before you ever go out looking for a home, before you ever look at refinancing. We just want to determine, do you have any of these trends that may create issues? If so, we're going to address those issues going in before we get to an underwriter and the underwriter just stops the whole thing dead. So qualifying income, probably one of the most important underwriting guidelines other than a credit score that you have to have a certain minimum for. Most everything gets down to qualifying income, doesn't it, Carrie?
It does.
It is the final determination of whether you can afford the house that you're buying or refinancing, and it affects your final loan decision probably more than any other single item. So let's look at how lenders take your income, your qualifying income, and then how they determine whether the house you're buying or refinancing is affordable. A lot of people call us up and say, hey, I make $50,000 a year. How much house can I afford? And that's a fairly complicated answer. So let's take, how does a lender look at the issue of affordability? What's the technical term that they use to determine affordability?
The debt-to-income ratio, or DTI.
That's right. If we want to throw an acronym at you, the DTI is the D debt to income ratio. And that basically means what percent of your income, your qualifying income, is it going to take to service your debts? And Carrie, the lender breaks that down into two different DTI categories. What are those?
There's the house ratio, which is just the mortgage payment, taxes, and insurance against your income. And there's the total debt ratio, which is the house ratio plus any other debts.
So you actually generate two debt ratios. And again, we'll try to make this easy. Let's say you had $10,000 a month income, wouldn't we all? And let's say your house payment is $2,000. The $2,000 house payment takes 20% of your income. So your house debt ratio is 20%. Let's say, though, that in addition to your house payment, you've got $1,000 in other payments, maybe a car payment, maybe credit card debt. You now have a total debt of the $2,000 house payment plus the $1,000 other debt payment. That equals $3,000. So your debt ratio, your total debt ratio, is 30%. Now, there are allowable guidelines, Carrie, that aren't really set in stone, but they're general guidelines. So in general, how much of a person's qualifying income can go to house payment?
About a third of it.
That's a good number, just about a third. And then total debt ratio, how much total debt can a consumer have and still qualify for the house?
40 to 41% will make you eligible for most of the programs.
Okay. As a rule of thumb, about 30% of your qualifying income go to house payment. About 40% can go to total debt payment. But Carrie, we sometimes have borrowers who may not be carrying any other debt. Are they going to hold a borrower like that to a 30% house ratio, or will they let that stretch a little bit?
Oh, no, they can definitely let that stretch a bit.
Again, the debt-to-income guidelines are not really set in stone as such. They are guidelines. They can be stretched. They can even be stretched a little bit beyond 40% if a borrower has better than average credit scores or more than average reserves left over, reserve liquidity. So our debt-to-income guidelines, we find, are probably one of the more flexible guidelines. When we get back, we're going to talk about other exceptions. Join us after the break. Thanks for joining us on this Saturday morning, and all you early risers, thanks for being with us. We're actually finding more and more people who are getting up early just to hear our show, and we appreciate that. Our loyal listeners have probably stretched from 3 to 4 now, I think.
Yeah.
And you are an elite. This is an elite group of people listening to our show, right? Very few who will brave a 7 o'clock on Saturday morning, and maybe you missed the early sections, but we're picking up here today on several topics of how lenders underwrite your loan, how they determine your income, your qualifying income, how they look at your debts, and in general, just how the mortgage underwriting process works itself. So stay with us. If you have any questions or missed anything, feel free to call us. We're in the office 8 o'clock to 5 every day, Monday through Friday, at 864-235-9596. So pick up the phone if you have a question. Particularly self-employed borrowers out there, do a checkup long before you plan on buying or refinancing your home. Let us take a look at where you are. You know, sometimes we even incorporate a strategy that says, okay, your last 2 years' tax returns look like this. You may not want to be so aggressive with your write-offs this year. You may end up paying a few thousand dollars in taxes because you reported a little more profit, but hey, you'll be able to buy a home. And you can make those kind of choices. We can help you with those.
And our long-term listeners may have heard us talk about income, self-employed income, particularly previously, but we've realized, you know, we give a lot of technical information, and sometimes hearing it again kind of helps you absorb it a little bit more.
Right, and then sometimes it's so technical, we forget it, but call and we'll look it up in the 1,800-page guideline book of the Fannie Mae underwriting guidelines.
We're really good at looking things
up. Yeah, we got a search index on that baby, and we can find anything. So we've talked about exceptions in debt-to-income ratios. And the debt-to-income ratios, which are your determination of affordability, can be quite flexible. You can often stretch debt ratios if you have higher than normal credit scores, if you're putting more than normal down payment into a transaction, if you have more liquid reserves, or sometimes one of the biggest effects to debt-to-income ratios is if you choose a shorter-term loan. Now, I wondered about that for a long time, but then it kind of became evident that for a borrower who has the choice of doing a 30-year loan, if they choose a 15-year loan, well, they pretty well know they can make that payment.
Right.
And in fact, the default rate on a 15-year loan is way less than half the default rate on a 30-year loan. So it's a safer product. When people choose a 15-year loan, they aggressively put equity into their home by their pay down of their principal, and they're the type of person who probably is one of the best financial managers because they're not stretching their budgets with a house payment. So the lender says, hey, if this takes up more of their income than the normal borrower, we know that it's actually a safer loan, and they'll let those debt-to-income ratios slide on up there. In order to get an exception, though, to the standard debt ratios, you must have an automated underwriting approval for those exceptions. We have all of the automated underwriting programs, and so we can plug your income in. We can plug your proposed house purchase price in, how much down payment you're going to do. We can determine in the front end, before you ever walk out the door to go house shopping, exactly how much house you can afford and whether you'll get the exception to the debt ratios. So take advantage of these tools and contact us if you're contemplating purchasing a home or looking at refinancing a home. So, Carrie, we want to move to the third segment of our program, and that is talk about down payment for a little while. Down payment is one of those factors that is most related to the default rate on loans. And it kind of makes sense that the more money a person has put into their home, the less likely they are to walk away. And conversely, those who have little skin in the game don't mind walking away early to avoid any difficulties. So the lenders look at down payment as a risk-assessing indicator. The more down payment, the stronger the loan. But each program has a different amount that is minimally required. So let's start at the top, Carrie. We've got two programs that don't require any down payment. What are those?
Those are VA and USDA.
That's right. And VA loans are loans for military veterans, qualifying military veterans. USDA loans, as we've covered in a previous show, are Rural Housing Development Authority loans. They allow a borrower with no down payment to purchase a home in a federally designated rural area. If you don't know much about USDA, go to our website. What's that website again, Carrie?
PreferredFinancialGreenville.com.
PreferredFinancialGreenville.com. And look up the USDA podcast and listen to it. It'll give you a lot of information. Those programs have no down payment. And as such, VA, despite that, has what I consider very standard qualifying guidelines, meaning that they are not going to overly scrutinize credit. As long as you're over a 620, you're probably going to qualify for a VA loan. However, USDA, we've run into some real hassles lately in that we have found that apart from about a 660 score, we are not getting many USDA loan approvals because it doesn't involve any down payment. The default rate must have significantly skyrocketed a few years ago because we're seeing a much more stringent underwriting for those loans. Now, we have FHA and conventional loan programs left, Carrie. What are the down payment, minimal down payment requirements on those products?
For conventional, we have a program with a 3% down payment and a 5% down payment, and FHA is a 3.5% down payment.
So a lender's risk is higher with lower down payment. And in fact, back in the 1950s, if you were going to buy a home, you could not purchase a home without putting 20% down. And the reason for that was that if a lender ended up having to foreclose on a property, typically a distressed property sale like a foreclosure is only going to bring in about 80% of what a house is worth. So the lender kind of protected themselves by only lending about 80% of what a house is worth. But in the 60s, some things came along that changed that. What happened was that there was a development of what we call private mortgage insurance, or PMI, and that was basically default insurance that said to the lender, all right, we're going to let this borrower put less than 20% down, and we're going to ensure that if you have to foreclose on the house, that if you lose money in the foreclosure sale, we will pay you your losses. And the entire industry developed slowly, but by the 70s, you could purchase a home with as little as 5% down. Nowadays, all mortgage products in which there is less than 20% down payment are going to carry some type of mortgage insurance. And we now, in the past 3 or 4 years, have come up with two different kinds of mortgage insurance programs. One is the standard monthly PMI premium. That's one that you're probably most familiar with. It's the one that has been around since the 70s or the 60s. And each month, a part of your payment goes towards this mortgage insurance. Once your equity in your home reaches 20% for conventional loans, that PMI stops being part of your payment. However, for FHA loans, it continues for the life of the loan. But now we have a new type of PMI structure, and it works really well for borrowers that have high credit scores, and we call that a lender-paid mortgage insurance. And effectively, what the lender does is buy a limited PMI coverage with an upfront premium that they pay, you don't pay it, and they offer you a slightly higher rate. Now, the combination of the higher rate increases your payment. However, the dropping of the PMI dramatically decreases your monthly payment. And in the end, we found that for most borrowers who have at least a 700 score, the lender-paid PMI ends up with a much better payment structure than the standard monthly PMI. So more and more, Kerry, I would say virtually every borrower that we have who's over a 700 to 720 score, we're putting on the lender-paid mortgage insurance program. Now, as far as down payment goes, Kerry, where does a down payment come from? Where can it come from? Where does the lender allow it to come from?
Primarily your own saved and earned funds.
Okay. And how does a lender go about defining what's saved and earned?
If it has been in your account for 60 days or more, they consider it saved and earned.
That's a good thing to remember. No matter where the money came from, as long as it has been in your account for 60 days when you apply for the loan, it's considered saved and earned.
Right.
Now, the lender requires us to provide the last 60 days of bank statements from all of your accounts, and we have to show where any deposits came from in that previous 60 days. And as long as it came from a paycheck, that's saved and earned. It came from a tax refund, that's saved and earned. There are insurance settlements, that's saved and earned. But we have to trace every deposit. However, if a deposit was made 90 days ago, it just never comes up.
Right.
It doesn't come within your last 60 day, and it could have come from a gift. But it won't be called a gift when you apply if it's been in your account for 60 days. Can people actually use a gift for down payment, Kerry?
Absolutely. And when we get back from the break, we'll talk about how to go about that.
Okay. And who it can come from.
Right.
Right. Because it just can't come from anyone. Anyone with a financially vested interest in the transaction cannot give you the money.
Right.
We'll cover that when we get back off the break. So join us down the home stretch.
Welcome back to our last little segment here. Right now we are talking about down payment, where it can come from. As always, if you have questions, give us a call at 864-235-9596. You know, we have people call us all the time and go, why does it matter where my down payment funds come from as long as I have the money?
Really, well, a common question.
Yeah. Unfortunately, statistically, it does matter, and that's why we have a lot of guidelines to conform to.
That's right. Receiving your down payment as a gift actually increases the risk of the transaction. Again, it's the old skin in the game thing. If that money came into your transaction, no matter how much it is, if it wasn't your money, it's easier for you to walk away when things get tough.
Right.
And that reflects itself in the default statistics. So a gifted down payment is rated at a higher risk. So we might have two transactions we run through automated underwriting, one in which we say, could this person get a gift for down payment? It can actually turn that loan down when if you say, what if this down payment is saved and earned, it will actually approve the loan. Especially FHA seems to really distinguish that very distinctly. And so we just have to run it through automated underwriting. We can tell you up front whether you can receive gifted funds.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, if you cannot, then the solution is this. Go ahead and get the gift, put it in your bank account, and then don't go house hunting for 61 days. Because once you apply for the loan, all we have to do is look back for 60 days to see where the money in your account has come from. So it's not something you're stuck with. But let's talk about who can give you your gift. Carrie, who is on the allowable list of who can give you a gifted down payment?
It has to be an immediate family member.
Okay, and what we call a near relative or a near family member, we have stretched that where there is a history of a relationship. For instance, I think we've managed to determine that a godparent, mm-hmm. who we had some documentation, they were asked to be the godparent of a child. They can give the gift. Domestic partners, we
sure.
can use that as a means of gift. That's a relationship that is documented.
Fiancés.
That's correct. Fiancés. Or future in-laws.
Right.
That's another
Actually,
one.
Actually, no. We did have a future in-law that they declined.
Really?
Yes.
Well, we'll have to change that on my radio show, won't we?
Yeah.
So, folks, don't listen to us because we don't know what we're talking about. At least I don't. Carrie does. Yeah, all of these things, they do get a little gray around the edges. What is clearly a person who cannot help you with the down payment is anyone who has a vested financial interest in this transaction. That means your seller cannot give you any money for down payment. Not in the form of equity, not in the form of, hey, here's cash under the table, not in the form of, here's a check, go cash it. The seller cannot participate in the down payment. Neither can the realtor.
Right.
The realtor can make a concession that lowers some closing costs, but they cannot give you money for down payment. They are going to financially benefit from this transaction. They cannot be involved.
And I do want to clarify, the seller can absolutely pay for your closing costs.
Yes.
But they cannot contribute to the down payment. And the down payment and closing costs are actually two separate things.
Thank you for that clarification. That is a good thing to remember. Now, Carrie, as with all things, there is one exception in which the seller is able to give a gift to the buyer. What's that situation?
If the seller is a family member and is selling the property to you.
That's right. You can have what is known as a non-arm's length transaction. That is where the seller is related to the buyer. And that is the only situation in which the seller can participate in the down payment by giving you the equity. And it's the only situation in which you can take advantage of standing equity in the property to use as down payment.
Right.
In a normal transaction, if you're buying a $300,000 house and you're only paying $200,000 for it, the lender is not going to credit you with that $100,000 extra as down payment. However, if the seller is related to you, they will do that, and that can be your down payment. You may not have to put any additional money into it, depending on the amount of equity being gifted. And the reason they allow that in a non-arm's length transaction is technically because the seller is related to you, they could give you a gift to buy the house that you're buying, and the money would just go in a big circle, so they just don't make it go in a big circle. They let the seller give it at closing and give it as equity. Just remember that down payment funds are traced and sourced. It's one of the rules and guidelines that has never changed in 30 years. We have to document your activity in your accounts for the last 60 days to see whether or not the money that's going in as down payment is saved and earned, or if it's come in as a gift, or if it's come from a source that is not allowable, in which case we can't do the loan.
And my disclosure here, I feel like a broken record sometimes, but maybe if I put it out into the ether often enough, everyone will remember, do not use cash. Please do not use cash. Unless you do it before that 61-day mark.
That's right. cash is not traceable, and they just the lender, if they see a cash deposit, simply subtracts that from the balance in your accounts because they can't source where it came from.
Right.
All right, so let's move on to our last segment, and that is the question that everyone asks, what is my interest rate going to be? Now, Carrie, before the crash, that was the easiest question in the world to answer. If you qualified for a loan, everybody got the same rate, regardless of their credit score. But
right.
That's not true anymore. After the crash, all lenders went to what we call risk-based pricing. And it does make sense. Someone with a, we used to hear before the crash, someone would have an 800 score and say, why can't I get a better rate? You know, you give me the same rate as a guy with a 620 score. Well, now that they do make your rate dependent on credit score, all the people with a low credit score say, why can't I get as good a credit, as good a rate as the other guy
right.
anymore? So somewhere in along the line, not everyone is happy. However, we live in an environment in which risk is assessed across the spectrum of the lending market, and one of those determinations of risk is credit score.
Right.
So when someone calls me up and says, Mark, what's your 30-year fixed rate today? I have to know about six different things before I can tell them.
Yep.
I need to know what their credit score is. I need to know how much their down payment is. Because, again, the lender affects the rate according to how much down payment you're making. You make more down payment, there's less risk, you get a better rate. Then I have to know what kind of property you're buying. Are you buying a single-family residence? Are you buying a condominium? Because condominiums, as a class of property, are considered higher risk properties than single family residences. So, you know, we can have an adjustment just because it's a condo and not a townhouse. And even though a townhouse may look just like a condo, it's not. And so your rate can be different between a condo and a townhouse. What are some other parameters that the lenders will adjust the rate on, Carrie?
Are you going to live in the property, or is this going to be
yeah.
a second home? Are you going to keep it as a rental?
That's right. Again, risk. What are you, if you have financial distress, what are you going to let go of first, and what are you going to hold on to till the bitter end? Well, if you have a rental house out there, you know, you might just kiss that one bye-bye so that you can not make that payment and continue to make your primary residence payment. Again, that results in a statistically higher default rate for investment rental properties.
Yep.
And it's just natural. We're human beings. We have to make choices sometimes, and sometimes those choices are difficult, but that's what we'll do. So, yes, if you have a rental property house that you're buying, you're going to pay a 0.75% to 1% higher rate for that house than you would if you were going to live in the house, simply because the default rate on that transaction is much higher, and you're going to pay the price and a higher rate. What other types of things can affect the interest rate?
If you're going to get any subordinated financing, that is additional financing at a lower loan amount to help with that first loan amount.
That's right. Or if you're refinancing and, say, want to keep your equity line in
right.
place and not pay it off, you subordinate that balance, meaning you keep that balance, you keep that loan in a second mortgage position. But again, now, in addition to what you owe the first mortgage holder, you owe the second mortgage holder, and there's more risk in that. So your rate is going to be affected by what we call subordinated financing. Then some other odds and ends that can affect your interest rate, Carrie, what are they?
Your loan amount. That's a huge one.
It really is. And we, in fact, one of the reasons we keep so many lenders is different lenders have different adjustments for loan sizes. Somewhere along the way, somebody determined that, well, I have to service five $50,000 loans. And if I do one $250,000 loan, it's the same income to me, but I only have to service one account. So what we find now in the industry, across the industry, is that adjustments are made for loan sizes. And unfortunately, smaller loans generally carry a slightly higher rate because there's more servicing for the same dollar amount, and that gets paid by the consumer in the form of a higher rate. And then finally, you can affect the interest rate that you get according to how many points you might be willing to pay. Now, in our market, when I get a phone call from someone asking what the 30-year fixed rate is that day, what they are usually asking me is, if I pay a 1% origination fee and no discount points, what is my rate going to be? However, any given day under any transaction, you can do one of two things. You can pay additional points to get a better rate. And conversely, you can say, well, I don't want to pay an origination. I want a zero origination, zero discount point loan. And in that case, you're going to pay about a quarter higher rate than what you would get with an origination fee. So answering the question, what is my rate going to be, is not simple. Now, that should not stop you from checking on interest rates. I have people call all the time and they say, I know you need all that information, but I don't want you to pull my credit. I don't want a credit pull. Just tell me what your rate would be if I had a 740 score. Well, we can do that. If you can describe the nature of your transaction and you know within a few points what your credit scores are, we can give you a rate quote without pulling your credit and calculate some payments for you to help you make your decisions and just kind of help you chart your way through there. The final thing that affects the interest rate that you may get is the program that you get. For instance, every day, even among the conventional loans, we have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac products. They're priced slightly differently. Then we throw in FHA, VA, and USDA. Those are different programs. They all have different interest rates. Best thing is, call us. We will quote you any program that you're eligible for. We can quote it under a scenario, or we can go as far as getting your loan completely approved, everything checked out, giving you a firm rate that you can lock in for free anytime you want to. Thanks for joining us this morning, as always, and we look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, if you have any mortgage questions, call us, 864-235-9596.